Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
Podcast while driving. Just checking it's on, mate. What I'll do is I'll talk about my death ray. Indeed, I discovered a death ray. And it's not until I read some other wacko people who'd also thought they'd discovered a death ray, like this famous Italian person who discovered the famous F ray, which I'd say is fake ray, and did all these these things, and Tesla, who's a complete nutcase after the turn of the century type of stuff, completely out with the fairies. But indeed, I discovered a death ray. Now, this is a podcast while driving. This is driving home, and we'll see what the traffic is like this time. And so there'll be a little bit of noise. It is bloody hot, and so I've got the air conditioner on, which I'll just turn it down a notch, because that makes a little background noise. I shouldn't have to make you enjoy the pshhh like that, and it's okay at this point in time. So, podcast while driving. While driving up, I described sort of a brush with, I suppose, some sort of complexity. My dictaphone not working. So I'm going to sneeze now. I can't. Unfortunately, I am not walking along, except I'm going to sneeze. Holding the dictaphone, I switched it off recording and sneeze. I think I'm getting across that at the moment. However, the problem was, this is before I discussed the death ray. Coming up, I had the problem of the dictaphone having a USB malfunction. And one of the things, if it's a USB malfunction, I can't get it on a computer and have a look around with it. And surely there must be a USB malfunction is a software thing. And so what I did is when I switched it off, I thought, oh, I should be able to format this. And indeed, I looked through the menus and basically put it back to original settings and then formatted itself, and it's obviously it's got some sort of basic BIOS, and so that should actually save it, should actually get that little dictaphone back on service. So I've got dictaphone number two. Dictaphone number two calls itself through another directory, so I have to write in a little bit of software to just flick through the various USB, to inquire what the USB ports are open, and then go through. That would be good if I could actually get to report back what USB ports are there, or I just make it go through all the different letters of the USB ports, looking for, just hunt it, fish around it, won't care all that much. Then I did a periodic table forward and backwards, and essentially right, and then what I've been told to do now is just have a diary and write down everything I do. And that's, I'll just have to get myself organised on that. I just have to think about how I'll get that particular task done. And the overall point is that although I feel I'm going backwards, all the measurements show that I'm going forward. Now, onto the death ray. So, essentially, I discovered a new form of molecule, a molecule which exists at extraordinarily high temperature in an arc. So an arc is well known for ripping every chemical known to humankind apart and very high temperature, ripping it apart and giving you ripping electrons off poor little atoms, ripping one, two, many electrons off poor little atoms, and it's a hellish thing. And so I actually discovered a molecular transition in a pure helium arc. And let's talk about two things. One is that it is a death ray in terms of a laser. It's ultra compact. And a long story is, what struck me is that the Soviet Union fished around with Tesla in the 1930s and paid him $250,000 for a to work on his death ray. Poor old... So I wonder what the Soviets were thinking. So too with me. I had the Chinese government poke around and put $100,000 in to keep the patent and the technology alive while they had a good look at it before dismissing it. And of course, I wasn't putting it forward as a death ray. I was saying, look, this is the technology. This could well be what happens. This is a new direction. And very much I now understand that people, or a lot of scientists, people in the position of being scientists do politics first and then only go forward with a bit of science which fits in with their narrative. And of course this eczema was not in their narrative. Now, just to give you an idea, a lot of transitions are, you can get atomic laser transitions in helium, and to get a laser transition, you basically need something called a population version. That is, you need a greater number of high energy states than low energy states. And in fact, the actual temperature of the laser transition itself is out of equilibrium, and it goes, a negative. I had a particularly hard rehab session there, and my throat's a bit dry, so I have to apologize for that. So you can have atomic transitions, continuous atomic transitions, at special point. So if you can imagine in a gas charge, this is for a gas laser, you've got to get a population version, and you pour in energy at the top at high energy transitions, and what will happen is that will float through a whole lot of energy states to lower and lower energy states. And if you can imagine this is like water falling down a hill. If you can arrange some sort of dam for the water to actually build up on the way down, this can actually store energy in a way that particles could go through this and take hydroelectric energy out of the dam and actually power a laser. So that's in a helium neon laser. Everyone once used to know helium neon lasers, and they are truly a good helium neon laser is to celebrate. It's just simply because it's so primitive, it's large, it's macroscopic, and the mode out of it is just poetry. You get a laser transition out of a solid-state laser, and yeah, it is lasing, but it's sort of not in the pure sense that a gas laser is going. The mode is mucky, and it's lasing on a variety of lines. Microscopic. If you put it to a spectrometer, in general, you'll get a series of little spikes of lines, and this is all together. You need different frequencies to go to give a different mode shape. Now, look, a fiber laser, you can't, is sort of an example. Well, look, there you go. A fiber laser, like an erbium laser, is technically a gas laser. So they've got rare earth atoms encapsulated in glass, and they're effectively, glass is it's not a crystal, it's a gas. Yeah, it's a condensed gas. Chaotic gas. It's a glass is a glass. And the actual particles in there, the rare earths in there, which lays like an erbium laser, are technically very close to a gas laser. So your fiber lasers, your gas lasers, very, very perfect. Eczema lasers, which you're getting into, are molecules which shouldn't be. They're like argon fluoride, various krypton xenon fluoride lasers. There's all the rare earths which bind with fluorines. They make a molecule, but the molecule is stable at its cited state. So if you can imagine, the molecule itself is that well up the mountain, stores the energy and drops down. So an eczema laser is basically searching for molecules which lays, and you've got to, eczema laser is this poetry of getting high energy in quickly, but not letting it heat up too much. If you heat something up, you overheat it. Firstly, you don't get the molecule forming, is one aspect. So for a molecule to form, you need it to condense almost. Well, almost. Unless you find something really out of the box, in general, it will have a small activation energy. And so if the gas is very high pressure, high gas, it's not going to have a formation. So your collision formation really relies to make a molecular laser. This is a molecule which is unstable, but builds up, and its route of decay is via light. So if light causes it to decay, it responds by giving the same light out. It's a good laser transition. And this indeed is going to be a talk about death ray. Well, I don't know. It's sort of like firstly, there is this fundamental missing step in that it doesn't actually it's got two factors against it not operating as a death ray. One factor is it doesn't really hold the energy for a long time, so it's the upper state is not held for a long time, a beautiful long time to go. And it's also you get a trade-off. The more tunable your laser is, the less strong it is. And the more ultraviolet laser, the less strong the laser transition is. Or it's not so much transition, it wants to do other things. So essentially you want your molecule to hang around long enough that it doesn't radiate spontaneously to go across. And so an eczema laser is one of these beautiful things. Essentially, you've got a tank, and you're cooling the buggery out of it. You have cooling tubes in your tank, eczema tank. You've got a long discharge electrodes, like this back, and you get a lightning bolt. Not a lightning bolt. It's not a lightning bolt as an example of an arc. You get this very smooth discharge coming across. And in order to get that smooth, beautiful discharge, you've got to eczema lasers are these beautiful, beautiful beasts. You have to, just before the spark reaches there, just soften the region such that it's conductive. You make the gas conductive by irradiating it with ultraviolet light and X-rays from sparks either side of it. So the sparks and that soften the gas, so when the capacitor discharges, it discharges in a a meter of, so if you imagine a spark a meter long but not condensing down. Now, one of the things you don't want in an eczema laser is this, so I'm just going to move out of here so you can hear me a bit better. Bloody hell. I'm just going to move off. How's that? I moved on a slightly better area of road so you can listen to me a bit more. So eczema lasers, you could not ask for a more joyous time. If you've studied molecular physics and you know about spectrum, the sort of premium experience one can have in life is making and maintaining an eczema laser. That's just molecular physics on steroids. It's the most enjoyable. I can't describe. I sort of rank I think when I listen to people describe a champagne, which a Bollinger, that they really enjoy, obviously they remember enjoying it. It's just the entire sensation, it's the entire ambience, the bottle opening. That's what it's like to run an ex-Malaysia. It's just absolute joy running an ex-Malaysia. These beasts are long since consigned to the scrap heap of molecular physics. Molecular physics, unfortunately, and gas lasers are real buggy whip technology. So it's sort of like people still love horses, but no one rides horses anymore. If you want a laser, no one would pay more than a cent for a laser, because it's actually, you know, something you put on a chip. It's something that's, the amount of physics behind it is beautiful. And you know how I poo-pooed the Bode pattern of solid state? Well, bugger me. Well, I shouldn't say that. They've solved that in the most beautiful ways, i.e. putting it through optical fibres. Beautiful mode, but you can't ask for a better mode pattern than a mode pattern of a fibre laser. A fibre has a mode in it. That's how it, you just can't ask for better. But even VCSELs, which is solid state stuff, they make a laser from a community of lasers which lays together in sympathy. So a tiny point laser would produce light in all directions. You know, like it would produce a light beam in, you know, easily 170 degrees if you had an individual VCSEL. But you keep on putting these little mini lasers together, and you can produce quite a nice beam of light on the surface. Like, it almost makes you weep to think about them. If you imagine a laser, a beautiful Gaussian laser spot, they also make a Gaussian distribution of these little lasers, microscopic lasers, you know, micron lasers over a millimetre distance to make a VCSEL, to make these beautiful, beautiful lasers. It's enough to cry. And of course, they can make these solid-state lasers with surfaces just so tunable, so fast, solid-state, so great. So I lived in a time, in terms of, like, I lived in a romantic time. Sort of, if you were into horses, it would be a bit like being in Farlap. Well, this is Australians, there's a romantic time of Australian horses when the 1930s, when there were gangs in the street, people wore those floppy hats and rode little fruit box carts, go-karts down the streets, and lived. It was almost a romantic time. And so one of the things is that you have this law saying that if you want to make a laser, you have to get a negative temperature going somewhere, that is, a population inversion. And to get a negative temperature, you want something which is hot to get energy in, but not hot, but not. You want it to then be cool. So for an eczema laser, which is getting to do a molecular version, you have to actually power that by this most gentle gas, where you heat it up, but the energy goes in such a way that it's geometrically, everything is Mulgara, I have to go out here. Yeah, you want to go there. So, and the reason that you don't want hot is that once you get hot, you start getting competing reactions. So, there's a temperature range for making an eczema molecule. You get the pressure up, the temperature too much up. Besides not forming this beautiful cloud of excitation where everything's all democracy, the discharge tends to go down, create a magnetic field which collapses and pulls you towards arc phenomenon. An arc phenomenon is where There's sort of two definition of mark is where the spectra of an arc, definition of spectra of an arc, is that if you look at the spectra, you are looking at the spectra of, you'll see the surface material removed in an arc. And of course, this is true and not true in terms of different arcs. But in general, for an arc and a spark, it's arc and spark. A spark is higher, is basically a low current arc. It's the best of my definition. An arc and spark, if you look at the spectra, you will see the electrode material. You know, it will be dominant in a classic arc and spark. And in essence, an arc will tend to wear down your electrodes. Of course, obviously, this is not true with carbon electrodes. And another definition of an arc is like a lightning bolt, is that the energy is such that there is some sort of magnetic confinement of the actual device of the... And I'm going to talk about this because I discovered this incredible arc which broke every possible thing that you is held sacred for. So an arc, everyone believes that you have incredibly high energy. The energy goes up. So if I've got, say, a tube 10 centimeters across, and I do a glow discharge, that glow discharge will be a uniform atmosphere going through, sort of probably building up in the center, a beautiful Gaussian thing down to the lower edges. But in an arc, you can see it, an arc will have a, will have this beautiful aspect. So an arc will actually form a magnetic bottle, a zeta pinch. Basically, a region can glow, but a lightning bolt comes down, it's a zeta pinch. And this is very high temperature. And this very high temperature creates effectively a vacuum. And when the arc is over, the air claps in and you get this thunderclap. So an arc burns a hole in the atmosphere. Puts it up to so high temperature, it doesn't create a vacuum, it creates 10,000 degree gas which expands, sort of pushes the air apart, and then when the air collapses down, the sound waves go through each other. So the air rushing into the, for a sound, you would hear a rattle. Now, I don't know if I could go through it. So, What if? So I've got a basic job to get done here. What if you could actually get a molecule which exists in a gas? In an arc. Now, I had the view that if I looked at an arc and I saw a molecular spectra in an arc, now, it's not rocket science. If there's a molecular spectra, if the light from an arc says, "Hello, I'm a molecule," there's a molecule in the arc, regardless of what people think. And there's a little twist to it, that this molecule produced spectra which looked like a hot solid body. So there's a series of things. Now, hopefully, I'll be able to talk about this a bit. Maybe I'll have to go on an episode to go across it. It's worthwhile looking at. So, what essentially is that I discovered a arc laser, potential death ray, if you will. Okay, keep on doing. Having completed that task, I'll continue the story about the death ray and the talk about lasers. So, it's sort of the fundamental thing that most people understand about lasers. I'm going to tell you about this death ray. It's very close, breaking several laws of common sense, but not all of them. Okay, so it's a death ray that could, you know, it's our best bet at a death ray, I would say, or an a laser. So the view that people have of lasers is that there's a basically a portal or some sort of barrel, and that light comes out of that and continues indefinitely in a little like a garden hose coming out, and it goes straight like a laser beam. And there's also the view that you can see it, and this is only from, you can see it moving from the cinema. Now, of course, lasers travel at the speed of light, and like any light, they diffract. So, at best, they can be as large as they are at their target. Oh, well, they can be larger. How do I describe it? Because they're diffracting outwards, they can diffract, be channeled in to diffract inwards, so from a large circle, you can, you just don't get laser light sort of travelling the way it does in the movie. Firstly, it doesn't travel in little, like little trace bullets, and secondly is that it's confined to go in sort of this hourglass shape, you can actually have where you want directing to the hourglass. Now, the actual angle of the hourglass, the larger your laser circle, the shallower your angle of your laser, your hourglass can be. So if you have, say, a meter wide laser, that could well, I suppose, depending on what the wavelength of light is, in terms of like the width of the laser, in terms of the number of wavelengths of light across of its aperture, determines the angle of its hourglass. It's called Gaussian optics if you really want to do it. And Gaussian is e to the minus x squared, and it sort of means it's sort of like a normal distribution. It's brighter than the surface and it tails off. And you can get the light to focus into a point, but if you get it to focus into a point, the tighter you get it to focus into the point, the other side of that point focuses out. And essentially, there's no such thing as a free lunch. There's no such thing as a laser pulse which stays together forever, ever going out. It diffracts outwards. So it will tend to expand. The other aspect of a laser light is that you have to have a medium for which, as far as the interaction that the laser is probing, the temperature of that transition is negative. The equations are quite simple, quite beautiful when you look at them and interpret them. So you can see them and interpret them as a sort of a piece by piece shot. But really, a laser is a transition where the temperature between the layer, it's a population inversion, and that is, the population at the top is bigger than the population at the bottom. So if the temperature of a body is infinite, there's an equally likelihood of all of particles being at each energy level. So a description of a atom with its electrons, or a body, is that you can sum up the energy, the moving energy, potential energy of an object. The energy with which you, it's the moving and potential energy of the object. So you can basically have a, if you imagine there's a bow which is not pulled, and then you can put energy into it and put it up to the top state of that bow, See if I can get into better road conditions for you. Okay, so you can get in the top state of that. You can then draw the bow with an arrow in it. And well, what happens is that you can release the arrow, and the arrow will fire out of the bow. Now, what happens is that you can say, well, the energy of the system pulled back and released is the same, but in one case it's stored in the bow arrow system. In the other case, when it's released, the bow drops in energy and the arrow flies outwards. A laser is such that if you've got an archer and the arrow whizzes past that archer is disturbed, if you like, to actually produce that transition. Well, it is this beautiful, beautiful phenomenon in terms of you can imagine your bow hitting your arrow hitting an archer and land. Say if it had the notches on both ends, it would go in and actually recharge someone else's bow. It's a bit hard to imagine that, but and that's absorption. But the Einstein equations to describe transitions say that you have this phenomenon that if you have a charged up bow and an arrow goes past it with the same energy and speed as it would if it was going to be released, it will also release it. So you can fire an arrow towards a person with a charged up bow, and as the arrow passes them, the next arrow, you get two arrows going across, and then as those two arrows go past, they hit the next set of archers who are all poised up, ready to go, and four arrows go across. Now, in general, two things can happen when an arrow passes an archer. I'm just trying to bloody well describe this. If the archer doesn't have his arrow poised ready to fire the arrow, it can go and the arrow can go into an empty bow archer and charge it up, and that archer can either fire it off again or just take the energy out and take the energy into his muscles or whatever it is. So you've got two things. You've got absorption, that's the arrow hits an empty archer and an empty bow goes in, recharges it, and so it can fire off a second time, or it can do everything else like that. Or it can actually hit a bow which is already pulled up, and the standard way you do that is by from underneath you put energy in and you push it up from underneath. That's the best way I can describe it. I'll get on to it. I was intending to describe a death ray, but indeed I'm just describing lasers instead. Of course, a laser has to be a death ray, but even so, it's got to be of certain characteristics. The smaller your death ray, the shorter range it has before it turns into just a little lead light, a lead glowing light. That's the best way. So the entire thing is to get those archers to pull their bows backwards in a way where the command comes from the top, and people and these archers march up or form around in an orderly fashion, ready to, if you can imagine, orders shouting and the energy comes down from inside, so from the top. That's the best way to describe it. So, indeed, when this is happening in an orderly way, an arrow can go past an archer with a loaded bow, and release one arrow, can then go to two arrows, and then pretty much soon that when I say fire an arrow at a target and it passes all these other archers, more than just one arrow hitting a target, a whole swarm of arrows hit. And but what's more, rather than the arrow just hitting anywhere on the target, because it's got all the other arrows around it, this is a bad analogy, because of the other arrows around it, that whole swarm of arrows travels in a, it's from the wind, if you like, is less able to be blown off target. And so you can actually build a light beam this way. And this is a laser physics dumb style, perhaps the dumbest explanation of laser physics I've ever given. However, for all this, the focus is on getting those archers ready. And in general, you don't want to actually have high temperature to do it, except in this arc laser, which I'll describe in a short little while in the next episode if I get onto it. Reminds me to, there's a lot of science that I know, I don't know, it's private science, and I'm going to try and explain it. So I apologize for this explanation for those trying to listen to it. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm back home now.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.